Some of us have drive, and some of us are beyond driven. Welcome to Beyond Driven Radio, bodybuilding's first stand. What's up, everybody? Welcome to another edition of Beyond Driven Radio. I'm your host, David Johnson, and with me, as always, Mr. Scott McNally. Scott, just fresh off of vacation. How you doing, bud?
I am doing really good, and I didn't tell you this beforehand, but with our guest this week, you know, we have him on two shows, so if it's okay by you guys, I want to call this the week of Justin Harris.
Justin, you get a whole week, man. How's that?
The worst week ever.
I was going to say, apparently being a podcast guest star on having a whole week dedicated to you doesn't make for the most epic week.
No, I meant it was your guys' worst week
ever. Oh.
Scraping the bottom of the barrel for an entire week.
I'll take the bottom of the barrel if it comes with some actual interesting insight and you know, we don't just talk reps and sets and all that stuff.
You're
good to go, man.
All right.
Not to mention, last time I talked to you on a podcast, you know, it sounded like you were in the middle of the woods, like with a tinfoil hat on, and, you know, we heard like every 12th word.
Yeah, I think I've upgraded to a better mobile device. So,
right. Nice. Well, it's funny that Scott said that with, you know, having you on multiple times this week, because I had wanted to call this episode kind of the art of the do-over, so to speak.
Hmm.
In part because, you know, really what I want to talk to you about today, Justin, I was a big fan of yours. You know, when you were making your run at becoming a pro in the mid-2000s,
and then
you know, 2015, 2016, starting to come back out of retirement, make another run at it, and just getting, you know, the contrast between the two different runs at the national level and possible pro card, and what changed, you know, when you were younger versus older with possibly more responsibilities, and what you learned from that, so... It's an appropriate Justin Harris do-over episode for the Justin Harris week.
Nice.
So, easy spot to start, Justin. You know, your run from 2004 through 2007 was really focused. You know, you won the overall at the Capital City Classic and the Mr. Michigan in 04. Bombed a little bit at Junior Nats in 05, but then won the Supers at Junior USAs in 06. And, you know, a lot of people had you poised as a front runner for USAs in 07, or top of the pack anyways. On a scale of 1 to 10, you know, during those years, that, you know, mid 2000s, how much was bodybuilding your life, your everything? I mean, what else did you have going on?
Well, I mean, I had a lot of other things going on, but it was all really bodybuilding focused also. So bodybuilding really was everything. I mean, almost to a negative point, and it actually got, I was just kind of, I think, too, I don't know that I'll say I was too focused. I think I was probably as focused as maybe you need to be, but I had too many other life things coming up, and it was kind of reaching a point where the focus, the obsessive focus on bodybuilding was not starting to mix well with normal life. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, not just in terms of the practicality of daily function, you know, being able to cram it all in. Emotionally speaking, you know, you don't strike me as the, oh, I have to get a pro card and my life's mission is all that and nothing else. You know, you always seem to have a little bit bigger picture than a lot of people making that run. But emotionally, how invested were you during that time? Like, did it start to actually, would you say, almost color your personality and, you know, just your emotional set, your day-to-day functioning?
Yeah. I mean, it was... My goal was always just kind of to create a bodybuilding life, I guess. I don't know a better way to word it. Always was good about, I always made more from bodybuilding than I spent on bodybuilding from my first competition on, you know, prepping people. And so I always tried to cultivate a concept of making bodybuilding my life, my income and everything. And I was really working towards that. But then I think what ended up happening was I just got, like, you know, too invested in it, and it stopped. I don't know, it stopped being a beneficial aspect. You know, it stopped benefiting my life and started kind of negatively affecting it, I think. And so I just in 2007, I think I got too emotionally invested.
Was that run when you really felt the impact start to hit, or were there like
yeah? Oh, and it hit really all at once. I just, from 2006, the entire offseason through 2007, I was, 100% completely dedicated. I ate every meal like it, measured out like it was a pre-contest meal. Every meal was planned. Every meal was the same. Every day was the same. My life was just complete Groundhog Day. It really was set up to work out that way pretty well. I was still working at the hospital. I was doing echocardiograms, and my shift was 12:30 to 9. And so it worked out really well to have the mornings to train. And there's really not other things going on in the morning. I didn't have, my kids weren't old enough to have sports, and things like that in the afternoon, and things that my wife and I, she was still in dental school. So our life was kind of simple enough that it worked out perfectly. I had the kids in the morning, I'd get them dressed, we'd have breakfast, and it was kind of quiet. They were young enough where they were still really pretty easy. You feed them, and one was a baby, one was two. So sure. It was, not that babies are easy, but they're hard in a different way than they are when they have events and play dates and sports and, school activities and things like that. So right. It was, as far as scheduling, it was simple. The kids were at that age were great on a schedule. So you get them up at the same time, feed them breakfast at the same time. As a 2-year-old, they're almost a little bodybuilder. And a baby, the same thing. They're eating every 3 hours, and so it worked out perfect. And I'd take them to the gym with me, daycare at the gym. We'd come home, I'd take them to their regular daycare. I'd go to work, my wife would come home, and so because she worked, had a normal school schedule. It was a medical school schedule, so it was 40 hours a week, but she was home by like 4, and so I wouldn't take them to daycare till almost noon, and she'd be home at 4, so they weren't in daycare very long. My wife and I didn't get to see each other much, which is almost, and if anyone's married knows, it's probably almost a benefit to the marriage because you don't have enough time to get mad at each other. So we appreciated the time we did spend with each other each night.
Right.
It just got to where I was trying to do too much with the business. I got too hyper fit. It was really the diet. I just, the prep for the USA's in 2007, I just got too overly hyper focused and obsessed with it. And really, I actually really burned out. I should have done better than I did. I burned out really in the weeks leading up to it. If the show would have been 3 weeks earlier, I probably could have done much better. It was kind of, you want to go through just sprinting across the finish line, at full speed, guns right. blades, and then I was kind of just limping across the finish line with a broken leg and a, torn clothes, and just kind of, struggling trying to finish across. And really, and this is really terrible, the only time I probably broke my diet for, I don't even know, maybe 2 years was honestly the week before the USA's.
Actually, Judson, I got to jump in here, man. I remember, personal story, my first show was in May of 07.
Uh-huh. Right?
100% natty show. And I'm in there one morning doing fastest cardio, and I was a fan of you and Steve Kukla, watching the DC training videos. I'd watch those every day for motivation, all right? Because I was training DC myself. And I'm on the stepper at like 8 a.m., and I see your big ass upstairs doing a photo shoot. I'm like, that's Justin Harris, right? I'd never seen a pro bodybuilder, whatever. So I came up, little kid, try not to interrupt you too much, but talk to you a little bit. But the funny thing is, I remember you going into USA's that year. There was a lot of hype, and I was following along. And you came in ninth, and I think, we all expected higher. I swear I remember you writing, an article about sodium loading and how you thought too many people depleted too much sodium, right? So didn't you purposely, like, crank your sodium through the roof to try to come in fuller and almost experiment at that show?
The honest truth was that wasn't planned. It was, I did that because I just lost it and picked out.
Okay.
for the show, and so I tried to think of a way to make it sound like it was planned.
For all the clients that you prep in the future.
Yeah, and I mean, it was really, that was a business decision to make that statement, because then I got to say, I wanted to test this theory. It didn't work. I make sure I try everything out on myself before I try it with the client. Where the truth was, while I really learned from it, was that if a client loses his mind and fucks up the week before a show, there's really no way to fix it.
So what'd you end up, now's your time to finally come clean after you told that story in the article years ago. What'd you end up doing?
Oh, I didn't want to even compete. I don't know what happened. It was coming up probably around 5 weeks out, and then, you know, and I was really losing focus, and Steve Kuklo moved to Texas, and so I lost my training partner, and, okay. And so, you know, not that that's a big deal, but it was just, I was traveling so much was happening with Troponin Nutrition, I was partnering with True Nutrition, it was True Protein at the time,
yep.
And I just even remember some of the things, like, I remember sending an email to Dante, and then I remember reading it when he replied back, and I kind of, his reply made me reread what I wrote, and some of the things I wrote, I was like, oh my God, I sound like a douchey bodybuilder, you know, I could tell from my email that the show was making it more important than it should have been, you know, mm. And I was kind of losing sight of what my non-obsessed intents were as far as growing a business, and I started placing the show above, you know, what should have been a huge business growth decision. Mm. And then it was like the Wednesday before the show. I think I took those last 3 days off of work or something. And it was, or maybe it was like the money, because it must have been before. It was before I flew out to Vegas. And I can't remember if I flew out Wednesday or Thursday, but I remember I started my carb up, and then just halfway through the day, because I was never home ever. I never, following the diet wasn't hard, because I was always. I left in the morning, didn't come home until night, you know, almost, you know, certainly during the week, the only, you know, 5 days a week from like 6 a.m. to almost 10 p.m., I had my meals prepped. I didn't even have a chance to think about not following the diet. And I don't know what made me think of it, but I thought, you know what, I'm going to go eat sushi. And it was the dumbest decision. And I think I probably went there with intentions of, you know, getting salmon rolls or something simple. And yeah. It was a sushi place that was amazing. And then before you know it, I went, you know, like the classic guy going on a, you know, losing his mind on a diet and telling his prep coach he ate the whole left side of the McDonald's menu. Well, that's pretty much what I did at the sushi restaurant. Only it was three days before my show.
Before USA's.
Yeah. And I think part of me almost wanted to, once I started, I was like, I just started, you know, I started thinking about how pissed at myself I was for the way I was approaching the show and neglecting everything else and putting, so, you know, you almost, it starts self-feeding when you start, like, you're pissed at yourself and you're like, God, what an idiot, you know, I deserve to blow this, you know, neglected my business and put so much emphasis on the show where, what, you know, at the end of the day, even if I win, what does it do for me, you know, is it worth, you know, setting aside the whole rest of my life just to, and then, you know, then I finished and I got home and then I had the eater's remorse of, oh my God, I just wasted 16 weeks of prep. What an idiot.
Wow.
Right.
And I, you know, did my best to fix that, but, you know, that was probably like a 400 gram carb meal with probably eight or 10 grams of sodium with soy sauce and stuff. And that's tough to come back from.
Right. Well, and this is, you know, a hypothetical question. You might not really be able to answer it, but if you were single, if you hadn't been married with kids, do you think it would have been, do you think you would have gone down the same path? Meaning, do you think you would have just slowly slipped more into that obsessive compulsive winning the show is my whole existence? Yes.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
But you needed an anchor to kind of keep you anchored to the real world.
Yeah, I can really get suckered down that path. Like the addiction. I've realized what bodybuilding does for me is I'm a 100% addict. If I never had a chance to really be addicted to anything else. I saw like the Arnold Classic on TV, you know, back, it was like on NBC, like the 1987 Arnold Classic or something, or 88 Arnold Classic when I was 7 years old. And so from then on, that's all I really wanted to do. And, you know, I got my first weight set when I was nine in like 1988, 1989 at Christmas. I joined my first gym when I was in 1994. I didn't even have a license. I was like 14. My mom had to drive me to the gym, you know. I walked after school and my mom would pick me up. And so it was, and I was obsessed straight from there. And then it branched off, you know, the addiction to training. It was more, for a while it was training for football. And so when I played football and I played at a small, you know, just Division III college. But I did really well and I was obsessed with football, but it was really what I was obsessed with was the weight training to improve myself with football. And so I never had a chance to be addicted to anything else, but I've learned since then that's what I am. I'm an addict. And if it wasn't bodybuilding and weightlifting, it probably would have been heroin or something. I don't even know. It would have been something, or alcohol or something. And so, without anything to temper that, without a family to temper that, yeah, I would have I would have went, I'm sure, without anything to kind of to put like a halt on it or any halting thoughts on it, I'm sure I would have went right down that path and probably to the point of shortening my life.
Sure.
In the pursuit of it.
No, I think, you know, people need to hear that, and I'll be 100%. Like, part of the reason I've always looked up to you, you know, not only your physique and your work ethic, but, you know, I feel a lot of kinship with your story. Having the ability to look at the bodybuilding thing and say, this is awesome, but you know what? I really shouldn't let it dictate every single fact of my life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's more to life. So, you know, I never heard this, and this isn't one of the questions I sent you, but I got to ask it, man. You know, in the aftermath of that, I know you did some powerlifting for a while, really excelled really fast out of the gate, but then kind of just, you know, vanished for a stretch. And, you know, We heard on Geared Up a couple years back where you went, and if you want to recount that. But what I'm interested in is, like, the aftermath of that. That had to have an emotional impact on you. That had to weigh on you somewhat. There's no way you invested that much for that many years, walked away after knowing that you kind of self-sabotaged, and then just, like, never thought of it again. So in the years between then and the more recent comeback, like, step us through some of the process, if you can. I'm sure it wasn't all bright and cheery.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. And that was immediately after the USAs. I was kind of emotionally wrecked, you know, just down, you know, just like completely like just angry, just not even angry, like down and defeated at myself for doing that, you know. And I, because I knew that it was my last show. I knew that I just burned out. That was it. I knew maybe not my last show ever, but I knew it's not like I was going to recoup and go back at Nationals. You know, I knew that was it, and I had moved on.
Right.
So for a little while, I kind of just turned that same obsession, just switched gears right to powerlifting. And so for about a year, I won the 2007 APF Michigan in 2007, which was, you know, I think 4 months before the USAs. And then I won it again in 2008, and that was in March. But really, probably from December to March, even 2008, I was really kind of struggling. I was kind of over it at that point, and I'd started reading. I had actually read a book called Probability One, which was kind of physics related. And then I don't know what triggered it, but I had never done anything with math. I'd never had an interest in math or anything in my entire life. I'd never even taken, you know, a calculus class or anything.
Yeah,
anything past the minimum you were required in high school, you know, and I tested out of math for college, so I never took anything there.
But okay.
Something about the equations just seemed really interesting to me, and so I switched gears, and for a while, I went, it was probably maybe 2 years, I went full-on obsession where I pretty much every minute of my life was math and physics.
Yeah.
And so I went through that, it was the same kind of obsession. I went from not knowing how to add or multiply fractions to, I taught myself calculus. I took Calc 2 and Calc 3 at the same time.
Yeah.
The next semester I took differential equations and linear algebra. The next semester I was already taking graduate math classes. I took a mathematical physics and complex analysis, a vector calculus class. And then within 2 years I had written a book on general relativity. And I was full on, I just, you know, and so within 2 years, I went from never, the same kind of obsession with not even knowing anything about math to taking graduate math classes and being in grad school for physics. But it kind of did the same thing. I've never learned to temper that obsession. And I went the same boat with that, where almost to the point of neglecting everything else in my life, all I did was think about math and physics, and I kind of came to the same head with that, where I realized that I was kind of neglecting everything else, and so I got a couple of years into grad school for physics, and at the time, I didn't think about bodybuilding, because I had another addiction, you know, and yeah. I remember even thinking, you know, looking at myself in the mirror and realizing I looked nothing like a bodybuilder anymore, and thinking, like, I wanted to look that way.
Yeah,
because I didn't like the way I looked, but I couldn't care. I didn't care enough. And because bodybuilding for me was never the addiction with looking like that. It was the addiction with the progress and the getting stronger and the being able to, you know, eating every 2 hours. Man, every 2 hours I got to be obsessed and addicted to something, you know.
Right. You weren't obsessed with the end state so much as the concrete steps that, you know.
Exactly.
Allowed for the end state. So yeah, let me ask. Well, and the funny thing is, hearing that about how you approach math and physics, you know, the type of personality that takes grad math courses in their second semester is also the type of personality, I'm assuming, who wins the overall at their first two shows. Meaning, like, you didn't, you know, no offense, Justin, but you didn't win those overalls based on genetics. You've said it many, many times, you versus Kuklo. You know, you have genetics for being strong, but you don't have super pleasing shape or blue muscle belly, you know. So, but to walk into your first couple shows and just, you know, take an overall like that, that's hard work and, to a degree, obsession, you know, obsessiveness, making sure that you cross every T and dot every I, which you did, you know. In the years that followed, I mean, did you deal with any, like, depression or anything like that, or was it...
That was what I was going to get to next, yep.
Go.
And then when the physics, when I worked to the point of where the, kind of where the genetics comes in, you know, where my obsessive nature can get you in, you know, get you into grad school, get you into the PhD program, but then you start running into people who were meant to be mathematicians.
Right.
You know, and they just, you know, you can do, if you really work hard, most people, if you have, a decent level of intelligence or a decent level of athleticism, if you work very, very, very hard, you can get to the bottom end of the upper limits. You know, if you,
right.
you if you are obsessed with baseball and live your life, you can work your hitting style, work your mechanics to become a good, good baseball player, you know. But at the end of the day, some kid from, you know, the Dominican Republic hitting rocks with a stick, if he's got that athletic gift, he's the one that's getting drafted and you're not, you know. And that's what I came into kind of in the PhD program. And it was a kid named Guyton, actually, who showed me, I had a class with him, and I realized just he was playing with a different tool set than me. You know, I could work really, really hard, but I was never going to make an important contribution to physics. And so just as quickly, it's almost like, you know, like just getting smacked in the face. And then I realized that, with almost that same sense of, I just wasted, almost like I wasted these years, you know, because there's no end state for me now. I never thought about the end. That wasn't the approach or the goal. It was, you know, the obsession with each new step. And I realized that I was not going to live my life in the physics world. It just wasn't what I was going to do the rest of my life. And then I really got depressed. I mean, probably clinically, you know, didn't know what to do. I was, you know, depression, it's not like depression, like where you sit there, you know, and mope about, you know, no one really knows. You go through your life and everything, and you do the same things, but it's just, you're not excited to do it. You're not interested in doing it. You don't, you know, you just kind of,
were you
dragging yourself through life?
Were you still working with clients through troponin nutrition throughout this time?
Yeah, I never stopped, but it was much, much lower volume, you know.
Was it hard?
No. I mean, the working with someone in nutrition, it's just, I've done so many clients, and it's just, there's nothing about there's really nothing nutritionally or conscious prep or anything that's difficult, I guess. It's just almost like second nature. You know, you've done it for forever and for thousands of clients. When a client sends you his responses, and you don't even have to think about it. You just know the changes that need to be made. And so that's really what I did. It was, maybe it was almost even easier because I didn't have the added, you know, when you're, was probably I'm the worst prep coach when I'm prepping myself, because when you're making the difficult changes, you have a more of an empathy and an understanding of how much it's going to hurt them, you know. Where I was eating whatever I felt like eating and not lifting, it was easy to make the changes because I had no attachment to understanding how much it was going to suck for the client.
Well, I meant more, was it emotionally difficult for you kind of having to sit on the sidelines knowing, like, even though you intentionally walked away and I think, you know, for valid reasons, for legitimate reasons that most people would say, hey, you're a better man for it. But at the same time, I know it impacted you and it sucked, you know, like you had to live with that and you had to wonder, was it challenging at times to, for instance, watch Steve Kuklo rising up through the ranks or helping clients that had the potential to maybe.
And I saw a lot, I had a lot of clients turn pro and a lot of former clients and a lot of guys that I had beat, a lot of guys that I had coached early on before anyone knew who they were. And so, yeah, it was, but it probably not in the way people think. It was very, very difficult but it wasn't difficult as though it was, you know, not difficult as, God, I wish I would have, that could have been me. It was, what was difficult was the fact that I didn't want it to be me, I guess. It was like seeing Steve and stuff. What was the most depressing was that I lost that drive.
Fire.
Yeah, it wasn't that they were, it was less that they were doing it. You know, it was less of, oh man, I wish that was me. It was, God, I wish that was me.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Well, and the other thing too, I mean, if there's pain involved with it, just by association, just by being around it to a certain degree, you know, it's a reminder of that. Even if you still love it, even if you still, you know, want to watch these people succeed and say, wow, I wish that was me. It still weighs on you a little bit, I'm assuming, on the psyche. You know, and it's probably not the easiest thing to go through.
Yeah. Well, so, yeah, like I said, it was mostly the hardest part was the fact that I didn't want to do it, I guess. That was the hardest part was just that, for whatever reason, I lost that drive, and I felt like I thought I'd never get it back, I guess.
Did it make you feel like a lesser person for it at all?
Yeah, I don't know, probably, yeah, I guess. I mean, yeah, but, you know, it was hard because I had the family, you know, and so, you know, if I ever mentioned that to my wife, you know, she'd be like, well, you know, lesser of what, you know? At this point, right. I was probably, she's like, for what? You're getting a PhD in physics and you feel less of a person because you're not making $0, but you're not selling gear to fund your next cycle. I don't know, you know. So it was hard to complain about it because I get that, you know, reality smack. But there's anybody who's been in the sport knows that doesn't satisfy you when you've been in the sport, you know.
Well, that's also a really modern notion, I think, you know, 20th century, 21st century, very wealthy American idea that, you know, a father's role is to provide, but then come home and play with the kid and be there for the wife and listen to the wife. Like, historically, I mean, the Vikings, the dad figure wasn't doing that. You look at Genghis Khan there, they weren't doing that. Like, there's something to be said historically. Male's, you know, role, so to speak, was to go out into the world and conquer the world. And bring back the bounty. And to a certain degree, like the people that we look up to historically or culturally or whatever, I don't care who it is, Michael Jordan, he wasn't around for his family as much as he could have been.
Yeah.
But that's what made him fucking Michael Jordan. You
exactly.
know?
And I think that's my biggest issue is if you are someone who kind of, you know, if was born in, I don't want to say I would have been great born in a different time, but you know, if you feel like you were someone who would have fell into that role thousands of years ago, you know, and anywhere you grew up as an athlete, you know, you grow up and you play sports and you kick ass in sport, you're captain of the team, captain of the baseball team, captain of the football team, you're playing football and you got that feeling of, you know, whoever you're running into, it doesn't matter because you're running them over, you know, that just like that primal, primitive, you know, anger where you're a king when you're more aggressive and more dominant than the person you're lined up against. You do that for your whole life from, you know, essentially from childhood. And I had like that classic boy childhood with, you know, boy cousins my exact age, and, you know, we would have wrestling matches and boxing matches and play war, and, you know, we'd have BB gun fights with real BB guns, you know. And also from birth, essentially, you have that whole competitive fight against people, and then, you know, then you play your last football game or whatever, and boom, you're thrown in the world, and you're supposed to just transition into working a 9-to-5, be happy to come home with no competition, you know, and even worse, any of those attributes are kind of looked down upon in the corporate world. You know, you're not supposed to be an aggressive jerk.
And the other thing too is like your whole life, and even nowadays in bodybuilding culture, like you're taught, and it's, you know, and it's true that like success requires, you know, going hard and being all in, so to speak. And, you know, being singular focused, I don't care what you like, any listener, do me a favor, go to YouTube, just look up motivational speech. I guarantee you the motivational speech that you pull up, whatever it is somehow going to talk about, you know, being all in, being hyper invested. You'll achieve your goal when you want to do this as much as you want to breathe, all that crap. So, you know, that's the truth. But then all of a sudden you're supposed to kind of just let that not be there anymore. And achieve this, you know, mythical balance that just comes naturally and easily, right? Which of
course, yeah, and anybody, well, that, and that's exactly, that's a perfect way to put it, because anyone who's able to achieve big things is almost by definition not someone who's good at balancing multiple things.
Of course. Well, and so let me ask you this though, you start doing the mathematics and the physics, and you know you're applying yourself really hard so you can get to the bottom end of the upper limit, like you said. And then you meet the guys that just have, you know, the different mechanics, the different apparatus to excel at it. At the same time, they're probably awkward. they're probably the types that can't go to a party and have a conversation with anybody or without having some anxiety or possibly having some Asperger's syndrome, mild autism, yeah. whatever. Oh, yeah. Not the stereotype, but, you know, like you said, to excel at one thing to a degree means you're not going to be good on average. It sounds like you're just naturally, you have a yearning to be, you know, great at some particular thing, whatever it might be, but you're also kind of a Renaissance man where you're pretty darn good at a bunch of different stuff, including not just, you know, fields, whether it's math, physics, bodybuilding, nutrition, whatever, but including, you know, life interactions, meaning you wanted a family, you wanted kids, you wanted to not be poor, you know, you wanted to provide. Yeah. And, you know, the people that excel in esoteric fields, oftentimes they don't have any sort of balanced life like that, you know. Not that that's emotionally satisfying to look at it that way, because it's not. You know, you watch, whatever, Rocky, and you want to be Rocky. You want to be the one at the end of the movie, you know. But that's the reality of it. So then, how about this? You know, obviously you started making, did you make your comeback initially, was it 2016, I believe?
Yeah, I don't even remember now. It was 2015 or 2016 Masters Nationals.
Okay.
I started training again in 2014.
Take us through, you know, if you want to give us a quick setup on basically what triggered, you know, you said that you looked in the mirror, okay, I don't look at your body, but what triggered this drive to make another run? But then more importantly, you know, knowing what you know now, how did you start going about things differently? Like, what did you know in advance you just had to do differently?
Well, what triggered it was, and it was just as quick as what triggered the switch out was, I was working on my research, and it was supposed to be PhD research, and which is much more in depth than master's. And my advisor, kind of to encourage me, I think, you know, said what I had done at that point. He said, you know, you're making really good progress. You'd have enough for a master's thesis. You know, it was a pat on the back to kind of motivate me, like, yeah, you're on your way, you know. And but he said master's thesis, and my brain said, oh my God, I could be done. So I literally went to the registrar's office and changed to the master's program, applied for my master's degree, and was done by that semester. I mean, within like 2 weeks.
Okay.
And that was the winter. That might have been the spring. Yeah, because it was, I mean, I guess in Michigan it's still winter. That was like March. And so literally I went, did that, and I was done. And then I thought, and I had 1 week left. I still had to take the exams for that semester. And I thought, well, now what? And so I thought, I'll go to the gym.
Yeah.
And it was just that quick. And so just as quick, I went, you know, and I was taking supplements again, and I was training again. And at first, I didn't know what I was going to do with it. And so I still was clean. And thought, I had been out for so long, I didn't even know where to get stuff anymore. I didn't know. I had left the world. So I didn't have buddies that were doing it. You know, I was, you know, all my buddies, I don't even say buddies, all the people I associated with were pasty white, 130 pound guys, you know, that were pretty much the Big Bang Theory in real life.
Right. You probably had a better chance at that stage of your life finding somebody finding a chemist who could make something for you.
Yes. Yes. And so I just started, and that was probably where I was at my best, as far as putting everything together, because I was training, but I wasn't hyper focused or obsessed, but it was satisfying, that kind of dopamine release of being addicted to something. I wasn't doing anything harmful to my body. I was, you know, looking for jobs, and I ended up becoming an engineer. I got a position as an engineer, and I liked what I was doing in engineering, and I was going back to training people. I was kind of promoting component nutrition again. But then I, you know, very quickly I reached that limit of what you can do clean, you know, and it was that first burst of having trained in a while. And so every day you're getting stronger and making progress, but then pretty quickly I hit like the low 240s, and not especially lean, but where, and then progress just stopped. And so then I got in touch with some old buddies and started back up, and I started growing really quickly. And then I met a guy, Randy Howard, who started training with him, and he did the Masters Nationals in 2012, and we just kind of started talking. And so he kind of wanted to do it, and this is like a year before. And so we talked about doing it the next year, and we started training together. And then this is where it went wrong. I started Muscle Mentor with Brad Hall, and I think it was my idea of a way to promote Muscle Mentor was to do a show. And so that was my mistake, because I went at the show rather than wanting to do it for myself, trying to do it as a business move.
Why was it a mistake?
Because if you're Dexter Jackson and you're doing your 900th show in your body and you've been competing consistently for 20 years and your body knows how to get in shape, you can do it half-assed maybe, or you can do it without any emotions attached. But when but contest prep, you have to be mentally invested, not just financially invested, if that makes sense.
Right.
I shouldn't have done the show. I was going through the motions, which will get you pretty close. You know, you can follow the diet, you can do the cardio, you can do the training, but when there's not that last couple percent, a couple percent contest condition is the difference between 14th place and first place. You know, that's really what it is, because 1% of body fat is enough to make a difference between placing and not placing. And when really what it was.
When you first got back in the gym after all those years off, I mean, even before you reintroduce yourself to supplements, was it surprising at all? Like, wow, this is hard and this doesn't feel great. Like, it sucks to hurt again. Or did you just hop right in and it was easy?
It was easy. And actually that was kind of depressing actually, because I remember having a discussion with my wife my genetics probably were better than I thought they were, because I went right in and my first workout, I had 315 for 4 on bench. And I actually tore my quads my third workout, tore my right quad. Because I went the first workout and I didn't know what I would squat, so I did 225 for 10. It was easy. So the next workout I did 315 for 10, and then the next workout I did 405 for 10, and I tore my quad that set. And so everything. I mean, and I remember the conversation I had with my wife was, I was like, man, I was still 240, and I was a chubby 240, but I told my wife, like, I went in, I haven't touched a weight in 6 years, and I did 315 for 4 my first workout on bench. You know, I can still squat 400. I said, it kind of made me feel like, so all that, I think mentally I thought, like, the videos I was putting out where I was strong, I was really proud, like, yeah, I'm strong because I'm working so much harder than everyone else. And that was kind of the realization that, no, I was just genetically lucky to be strong. And so I wasn't stronger because I was working harder. I was stronger because I was meant to be stronger. And so that was, I think, and so it was almost kind of depressing, actually, how easy it was when I came back, because I was pretty strong right away, even while clean.
Well, to a certain degree, though, that has to be because you actually had already laid the foundations. You had the nervous patterns to a certain
degree. I'm sure that helped. But more than anything,
like you said, like, you just had that, almost that mindset. Not that mindset or personality is a genetic thing, per se, but you were just oriented to just go in there and be full tilt tunnel vision, you know, like, that's what you're good at.
That's really the only way I can train. I've had talks about that, about actually training styles, because I tend to gravitate towards, like, the DC style or the way Jordan Peters kind of does things, which is kind of a lower volume, you know,
right,
really focused on progressive overload with weights. And I say, I enjoy that, but I probably personally, I don't think that's the best training approach if you have the best genetics for bodybuilding. And my views are just observational on that, but there's been no bodybuilder of the last 30 years who's been, you know, top 5 at the Olympia training that way. Every top guy for the last 30 years has done the same one body part per day, typical bro science routine. But what gets me excited to go to the gym is to go in and just put it all on the line for that one big set. So that's always what I'd like to do.
All right. So let's go ahead and, you know, get into a little more detail then with what were the distinct differences with training, diet, you know, if you're willing to go into it, supplements, between your run back in, you know, 2005, 2006, 2007 versus, you know, your comeback in 2015, 2016. You know, you're talking about strength levels. You've always been known as a very strong person. You know, we all remember the 500-pound front squat video, 635 deadlifts and busting a vein in your forehead, all of it. And I think in addition to the quad tear, you said you suffered a partial pec tear when you started to come back at it. With that, you know, as you started seeing this stuff kind of add up and accumulate, how did you have to modify your training, you know, for your comeback? What specific exercise you just had to avoid, or did you start increasing volume and, you know, not going past failure, not rest pausing? You know, give us some specifics on that.
I really didn't modify my training, and okay. I'm starting to pay the price for it. I went through various phases of motivation as far as how hard I was training.
Yeah.
I've got right now, my left hip has been a problem since the mid 2000s, and that's not good. But right now, my right knee and my left shoulder are really, really bad. Where I'm for the first time, I have to really avoid exercises, and I've never done that. And I'm really struggling because some of the exercises I have to avoid are exercises that I really enjoy. And my problem is I'm not, you know, those guys that go in with a string tank top and love seeing the pump and love seeing the way they look in the mirror.
Right.
I'm not that guy. I love making a new PR on a lift. That's
right.
Always been what gets me going in the gym. And going in, that's why I always sucked at contest prep, because as soon as I start losing strength, I lose all focus. I lose all motivation to go to the gym. I can't get motivated to go and see how lean I am in the mirror. That just doesn't do it for me. And
sure.
So I'm struggling with adjusting to training where I can't do lifts that I, how do I stay motivated when I can't do the things that keep me motivated?
Well,
the hardest thing coming back was the diet, because I went through years of eating, however, you know, not even caring how much protein was in a meal. So it was very difficult to go from that eating food that tasted good to getting in the mindset of eating, you know, chicken and rice every meal, especially because I have a huge appetite.
Okay.
So I'm always hungry, and so it was difficult to get in the mindset of eating food that didn't taste good when I was hungry, I guess. And I really struggled with that all the way through the contest prep.
Well, so how'd you do it? I mean, you obviously did it to some degree. I mean,
I didn't really in the off season. I would do little things that I never would have done before, like add a little bit of cheese for flavor to a meal, or I would get, you know, like Chipotle, and I would add guacamole or queso to the meal, which I would never do before. Or if I was having like a high carb day, and I would allow myself X amount of simple sugars before, I might use cereal, but I would never dare add milk to it. I would just eat the dry cereal. Where now I would add milk to it. You mean little things that most people, especially people with a good metabolism, probably don't think it's a big deal. But I don't have a good metabolism. I would be the classic football player physique. I have, you know, I could be 300 pounds, you know, putting up the kind of lifts I did at my peak with probably, and do it completely natural. I would just be 30% body fat. And I have the appetite to do that. I just don't have the metabolism. I have to be very, very precise with my calories to stay lean in any capacity.
Okay.
And so I got too fat, and that was the other thing. So when I started my contest prep, it was just, my metabolism was never great, but it was even worse than it was before. And I was starting from a body fat position much higher than I ever was before. And I was making the switch of making those little additions to my food to make it taste a little bit better, where I could no longer do those at all, you know.
So essentially, it's a bad boat to be in, and I only say this because I've been in it myself, but essentially you're older, you're mentally weaker, and physically weaker too. So
it's a tough hill to climb.
Right. You kind of got everything working against you all at once. So with that, and how did you have to do like a ton more cardio just in order to get in shape? Do you have to push the envelope really hard with that?
I should have, but I didn't. I just went the starvation route mostly.
Okay.
I wish I could just remove that show from the record, because I didn't do I didn't do the things I should have done, and I didn't do things the way I would have done if it would been a show I was doing for any reason other than hoping to promote. It was stupid. I should have realized, and I realized, you know, at some point before that this was dumb and this wasn't going to work out. But in my mind, I was thinking, you know, put it all because you kind of have that business mind where you think, put it all together, turn pro, it's going to be great for business, you know?
Right.
And you'll come back and you'll get that pro card that you regretted never getting, you know, and then, but you could think that and plan that out and put it on a spreadsheet all you want, but if your heart isn't there, it's not going to happen. I mean, in any sport that's not going to happen, it's going to be bodybuilding, because your heart's got to be into it 100%.
Sure. Well, if you're self-imposing misery and suffering on a daily basis with, you know, the diet and energy levels and all that, yeah, if your heart's not into it, you're not going to do it. You're planning on making another run at it this year in 2018?
I would love to. I'm
not sure yet.
I'm just really busy. And I know everyone with a family is busy, right. But I work full time. I do troponin nutrition. I do muscle mentor. I just started a project with Steve Kuklow. My wife and I own, actually storage units. We own 46 storage units. That isn't a huge workload, but anytime we get a new renter or a renter who's not paying, I got a 40-minute drive out there. I have four kids, and I calculated this out. I counted it out before. I have four kids, and between all the sports they play, we have 13 to 16 events each week between practices and games. And I coach three of the sports. So I coach two basketball teams and a travel softball team. Minimum of 13 events each week. And I think between practices and games, I'm coaching seven of them. So there's, 2 to 3 days each week where there absolutely is not time to work out. And so I kind of trying to find a way. I have it right now where I can train 5 days a week, but there's it's not training in the sense that I'm holding a 2-year-old until 5 minutes before I'm at the gym,
right.
So my brain, half the time I'm in the gym in dress socks still from work, or there's just, yeah. I don't have the time to put the thought into it. And there's only so far you can go with that. And
right.
I'm really motivated to train and stuff right now for whatever reason, the most excited I've been about it since 2007, but it's very difficult because there's, so many times where I'm doing kind of a Jordan Peters style routine right now, actually, which in my mind is kind of a DC style routine because there's a lot of the rest pause and the PR focus and stuff. But I'm doing that, and the problem is, when I reach a plateau on an exercise, I need to adjust the workout and change out exercises. But every time I plan to, I don't even get a chance to think about the workout until I'm in the gym.
Right.
But I can't take the time even while I'm in the gym because my training is, I drop one daughter off at gymnastics, and I know I have exactly 60 minutes to be in the gym before I have to leave to pick her up from gymnastics. So, I can't, there's not a minute I can waste there. So that's really what the limiting factor will be, I think, for competing. It's not going to be the motivation or the desire. It's going to be the time, the ability to fit it all in.
Well, the reality is this will sound dismissive, and it's not meant to be at all because I'm a father and a husband as well, but it's not the top priority. The top priority is being there for your kids and being a good father and working a job and making sure that they can go to college, and because they're not going to give a shit if you turn pro, and that's exactly the reality.
So yeah, all they're going to remember from the contest prep is the fact that you weren't mentally there to play with them. So I understand. Right. So that's a move that, well, personally as a father, I feel that fathers don't get the credit for it. It's kind of a societal push or kind of a societal thought of always congratulating the mother on how much they sacrifice for the family and stuff. But, I think as a personal note, I feel like fathers kind of get the shaft on that, and that, we set aside our hopes and dreams to some extent too, to keep the family running smoothly.
Right. So. Oh, absolutely. All right. So, if you're willing to go into it, and if not, that's fine. Scott can edit this out if need be, but between the first run and the second run, was there anything that you really were set on doing differently when it came to performance-enhancing compounds, things that you just, on principle, wouldn't touch, whether for safety or whatever reason, or things that you just saw, at my age, this isn't going to be the best route, anything like that you really thought you had to modify the second time around? And that could be because, you had in the back of your mind, like, hey, my family's my top priority, and, I can't do what I did before.
Yeah, I mean, to an extent, I really kind of have a disassociative view of that as of health. I'm kind of childish in my views of I'm able to ignore the future, and I'm not good about, if I didn't have a family, the health aspect probably wouldn't play in my mind much at all. The reason I didn't work out when I wasn't trying to compete is because I had zero interest in being healthy, and going to the gym for any health reason.
Right.
You know, I, I remember saying the way I worded it, my wife thought it was funny because I think she kind of mentioned something about doing some exercise thing together. And I was like, oh, I can't go to the gym and be healthy. And, you know, in my mind, that made perfect sense. Like, what's the point? That's stupid. You know, I'm there to build muscle.
Right.
And so not really. I mean, I've always done blood work and always tracked that. And I've never had any major issues as far as health from gear related stuff. One thing that I wouldn't do when I came back was insulin. And that's because really, cause my daughter's a type 1 diabetic. And okay. So, just kind of, hang on 1 second.
Done.
I'm upstairs. I just closed the door to make sure there's certain things I don't want the people to hear, but just because of that and because of what she has to do unwillingly every day with that, I thought it would be too selfish of me I would have just been angry at myself, I guess, for using something that, you know, as a benefit to my life is something that she has to use unwillingly every day. So that was really the only thing. But I jumped right back in with doses and without really a worry about, I guess, I don't know. I mean, I think maybe health was a bigger, because health is always in the back of my mind. And I get blood work every 6 months. And if anything's abnormal, I get it checked again 3 months later. Right. I've kind of been lucky. After the Masters Nationals, when I did horrible, I did go through I got to do that again and come back better. And I got really big. And last year, at the end of the year, I got a little over 300 pounds. And it was the biggest I'd ever been by far, body weight wise. But my blood work started getting worse. And it got to the point where the first time my creatinine was above normal and my GFR was below 100. And which was kind of the first trigger of, that's, you know, below 60 is really where they consider high, but GFR is really something that doesn't come back. You know, you start out with whatever it is when you're born, and the kidneys just slowly get less good at filtering until, you know, eventually they get so bad. Usually you die of old age before that ever happens, but you don't get better typically. You know, it's like a coffee filter. If you spray high pressure water or a coffee filter and it starts ripping it open, it doesn't seal back up again. It just never, you know, it never filters as good again.
Right.
So I took a step back and I had a 24-hour urine clearance that showed my GFR was like 135, which is really still pretty high. But that was last year, and I kind of took a year of like TRT. I don't know if this is even really answering your question, but I took a year of like TRT and brought my weight down to like 250 before the end of this year. Now I'm going about things with health as a higher priority, I guess.
Sure. Well, I think it answers the question only in the sense that, you know, people want to be very opinionated. You know that everyone's judgmental of how everybody else does everything, and everyone knows the perfect balance of exactly how you should live your life.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reality is, I see everyone in the sport right now pointing fingers at everyone else for doing things that are unsafe or unhealthy or whatever, when they're, you know, doing things that technically don't need to be done either and in no way contribute to their health. You know,
yeah. That's
reality. So every one of us, to some degree, is choosing how much we're going to prioritize optimal health, you know?
Yeah.
And optimal more willing. Health. Yeah, optimal physical health.
But I think that's an important differentiation because for me, like I said, with the if I don't have something to be kind of obsessed or addicted to, I'll be addicted to other things. So for me, I know that I'm trying to find a range of physical health that also satisfies the mental health, because I could remove any of the risk of physical health and be completely physically healthy, but I know mentally I would be so unhealthy that it would lead to other unhealthy pathways, like, you know,
right,
maybe alcohol or something like that, or eating really poorly. So,
well, and then the other thing, I think you can take that concept and take it even further and more abstract. Like, anytime you're pursuing a value, it doesn't matter what, it comes at a risk, you know, like you get in your car because you want to drive faster than you can walk and you could get in a crash and die. Does that mean you should relegate yourself to walking for the rest of your life wearing head pads, knee pads, elbow pads? Like, yeah. What kind of message does that send then to your children that they should be scared little things that cower in the house? And, you know, so it sounds like you're taking what I would say is a really smart approach, which is monitoring your health, you know, closely within the context of what you love, knowing that if something goes south, this isn't your top priority. Your top priority is your family, you know, being responsible, being a good father, et cetera. And I think that totally answers the question because I myself have struggled with that. You know, how, like, I shut down my own run early in 2016 and it was going to be my only run at the national show. And I, not like you, Justin, I had no chance to turn pro, trust me, but I just want to do it, you know, and not look like an asshole. And as I was going along, I just hit a point where I said, you know, I'm starting to make compromises that I wouldn't be comfortable making 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And my daughter's getting old. And unfortunately, like, that was what was necessary for me to go further. Like, I was training full-blown. My diet was on point. You get the point. So at a certain point, the other thing that you can up the ante on is gear and you know, other performance-enhancing compounds. Problem is, when real life is weighing on your shoulders heavier by the day, is that... Yep. You know, the appropriate, responsible thing to do. Again, if you're young, 22 years old, you don't got a family, who the fuck cares? Do what you want. It's your life, you know? So I think it's important to hear that no matter what age you're at and what total responsibilities you have in your life, you're going to have to do a calculus and you're going to have to figure out, you know, what's reasonable and what's not reasonable. So when you made your comeback in 2016, 2015, you know, you had a lot more on your plate with family and real world responsibilities. How did that influence your perspective as a prep coach working with your clients? I know you said the years that you stepped away was almost easier because you weren't directly feeling, yeah, you know, pain, what they're feeling. But did you start to have any more empathy, would you say, for those that were struggling due to like family issues or balance and finding the time to get in what they had to get in? Or did you just say, hey man, this is the game, you signed up for the game?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit of both. And, you know, as far as, I definitely have empathy for people because I understand it. But then you also, the, you know, the finish line is the same no matter what your course is, you know. So these, right, people that have all the other stuff, they're still competing for the same finish line. And so, you know, I just try to I discuss that, I guess, more now with clients, I guess, than maybe I did before, where, you know, you realize that if you want to do a show and you want to win the show, that winning the show means the same and the same finish line as it does for the guys who don't have a family. And you know, and so you to do this, you're going to have to make decisions that you might not want to make. And, you know, I'm not a psychologist, that I'll listen to your issues and, you know, but, and I can't tell you what's the best decision for you. I can tell you that if, you know, if this is your goal, I can tell you what to do to get there. And, you know, we can work around what you're able to do. And I really think as a prep coach, when I see what other people post online and stuff, I probably am better about that, about working with people. Cause I'm not the kind of prep coach who, I don't post where my clients finish, you know, and I don't, right. So I'm there to help them achieve their goals within the realm of what they're able to do through the rest of their life, you know, with everything else that's going on. And so I'll work if the client, you know, they'll always ask me, they'll think, you know, they'll say they want to do the show, they've never done one, but they have all these things going on. Will I still work with them knowing that they're not going to be a pro bodybuilder, you know? And I definitely will. And most of the time, those are the most enjoyable clients because the type of prep coaches who only want to work with the people who pad their resume, the thing is that's great, that pads your resume, and you look great in the eyes of other bodybuilders who are looking for a prep coach because all you guys do good. But the guys that pad your resume are never your hardest people as a prep coach. Never. The guys that pad your resume are the easiest every time because they're the genetic freaks who look great no matter what they do, look great no matter what cycle they do, look great, you know. And any change you make is the right change. Any adjustment you make only makes them better. So those guys are easy. And most, for me, probably 99 to 100% of the time, the guys that look best on stage and do and place the best are my easiest clients to work with, as far as not easy in just that they listen, and easy is that their bodies just soak up everything you do.
Right.
You know, and that's the genetics. So I think it's always funny when you, when prep, I don't, I really don't want to call out any prep coaches. I don't have anyone in mind when I'm saying this. And because there's a whole range of different prep coaches that I think are great and some that I think are overrated. But I, and I'm not isolating any of those in this thought. But when you see the prep coaches, it's really the worst way to judge a prep coach is how well, how good their clients look, just as compared to every other bodybuilder. You really want to judge them how good they look compared to where they started and what else they have going on in life, because the clients that look the best overall are almost always the ones you have to do the least amount of work for.
Right. Well, that's just providing context when you provide that. You know, it's easy. It's easy to show, you know, see some Mark Cuban on Shark Tank or whatever and see his $10 billion house and his wealth and his riches and say, wow, that's great. It must be great to be you. But you're not seeing the years and years and years of all-nighters and not going out with friends and whatever. Yeah. You're just seeing the glory at the end, you know. Not the, so until you have context, you're right. It's kind of meaningless. And I know exactly what you mean, where my most successful clients, in terms of how far they got, people would always step back and say, holy crap. I'd say, you know what? Like, I can't even take credit, man. Like, I just showed up and pulled some carbs out, and the rest just happened.
Exactly. That's like like when Phil Heath walked into the 2005 Junior Nationals, and because I had, like, seven guys in that show, and I competed in that show also. You know, and actually, one of my clients took second to him in the heavyweights. He probably would have won heavyweights any other year, you know, over about a decade span if friggin' Phil Heath didn't show up. But we're talking to him backstage. And the guy at that point was so green to the sport. He knew almost nothing, you know. I mean, it was, he knew nothing about cycling. He knew nothing about contest prep cycling. He knew nothing about dieting. It was basically, you know, like, well, he just, you know, ate some meat when he was hungry. And he knew he was, you know, and ate less carbs than he did most of the year. And, right. you know, and he looked like Phil Heath. And so, like, taking the credit for a guy like that is, you know, is simple. You tell a guy like that to, you know, go work out 5 days a week and eat meat and rice every 3 hours, and he's a pro bodybuilder.
Yeah, not yet. So let me ask you this. I mean, you work with clients who are off-season as well?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So knowing that...
Most of my clients end up being year-round clients, and I really... I have clients I've worked together for years, and I kind of try to foster that. I do... I discount my price pretty dramatically after... More than 50% after the first 3 months to kind of entice them to keep working with me.
Well, not to mention the initial programming is done at that point. It's more tweaking and butt pushing, and, you know, the actual investment in them becomes easier. Given, you know, that you kind of had this insight that you kind of hit burnout just due to being so hyper-focused during those years, including in your off-season, has that modified your perspective on how you work with others in their off-season, whether it's, you know, encouraging them, hey, you know, purposely deload more frequently or have a cheat meal? Yes.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah. And I think if there's one thing that I'm actually very proud of as a prep coach is how I've handled young genetically endowed bodybuilders like Steve Kuklo or Dominic Trivilini right now, and a lot of guys over the years who've gone on to that maybe could have done pretty big things in the sport who have found a good work-life balance. But as I've really tried to force that idea of like Dominic Trivilini, he just turned 21, you know, and so I really tried to emphasize the idea of, you know, you only have that whole lifetime, that phase of your life once, so find ways to enjoy it. And so same thing with Steve, you know, I really always kind of worked with when he was young, you know, I set him up with a financial advisor. Always talked about, you know, the financial aspect of the sport and how you only have so long to compete, you know, and don't get so wrapped up in the competition that you neglect the other ways. There's lots of money to be made in the sport. You have to hustle for it. And Steve definitely took it. I mean, he's doing better than I think most people even realize financially. Well, I guess, you know, everyone knows about a Shark Tank now. So, you know, and he's very intelligent business-wise, and he, you know, he kept a job as a firefighter for years where he was making, you know, 5, 6, 7 times as much outside of, you know, being a firefighter was basically an income he didn't even carry needed, but he kept it long enough to, you know, to get some kind of pension out of it. And I'm trying to do the same thing with Dominic right now. And so I feel like I'm good about working with guys and getting the most out of the sport of bodybuilding without hyper-focused and burning out. I don't know. I don't even know if that answers your question either.
No, it totally does. And I think, you know, it's props to you, because when we talk about coaching and whatnot, and, you know, there's a giant agenda nowadays with Instagram coaches. Everyone's a coach without having any credentials or without having walked the walk. You know, but at a certain point, you know, there's going to be different sorts of coaches, obviously. There's going to be button pushers, or what, if you want to call it a technician, you know, somebody that pulls a little bit of carbs, whatever. You know, but they never kind of graduate to that next level of having a legitimate relationship with the individual, you know, where they know more about what's going on in their life, their family, you know, where's their head at? You know, why are they doing this? Why does it matter? And is it, I won't say for the right reason, because it's not my place to judge a client and their aspirations, but, you know, you want to kind of know, are they coming in with insane expectations? Or a lot of people really come into competing thinking like it's going to be their ticket to fame. You know,
Oh, so many guys. And that's, I don't know, not only their ticket to fame, so almost everyone, when they do their first show, and then their next thought is, well, I'm going to be a pro bodybuilder. And it's not just that that's their thought. Then they have it in their mind that they're going to be a pro bodybuilder and they're going to be Jay Cutler successful.
Right.
But without a plan or a thought of how it's going to happen. And it, in this sport, I mean, really good at suckering you in and kind of, because you're so focused on the here and now, you know, every 2 hours or every 3 hours, you're focused on the next meal. And it's so much in the moment that it's really easy to not really think about the end result in your mind is pro bodybuilder fame and wealth.
Right.
But it's really easy to not think about how exactly you're going to get there, because you can think about, well, the first step is this next meal. So if I nail this next meal, that'll get me to the fame and wealth. And you kind of neglect, you don't see the forest for the trees of, well, even if I do turn pro, I haven't set myself up for the wealth part. And there really isn't fame, because there isn't, the pro card really has little to do with fame anymore with the social media aspect of everything.
Right. Well, and the other thing too is, you know, unfortunately, that's kind of the shtick that is sold these days, you know, whether it's on Instagram or, you know, the IFBB, the NPC, everybody, the whole competition world. Justin, you know as well as I do, the only people that make money in this field, in the sport, are the people not competing. You know, it's the coach, the officials, the suit makers. So, of course, there's something, I want to say, you know, I don't think it's ever justified to purposely mislead, but it is a modern idea that, hey, man, that's business. I'm selling them the dream, and, you know, they want the dream, without really telling them all the details involved. It sounds like you're holding yourself to a little higher standard there, in part because you were never chasing the end result so much as the process. Yeah. And in part because, like, you know the reality of it. Like, you love bodybuilding and selling, you know, if a new kid comes to you and says, hey, I want to go pro by next year, and you say, sure, let's go, you know, that's disingenuous. And over time, that reflects on who you are and your reputation. So, all right, Justin, well, this has been incredible, you know, really helpful, honestly, for myself, because I've gone through a lot of this myself in the last couple of years. I normally end up by saying, you know, what are your projects coming up in 2018? How can people reach out to you? But I'm going to give you the floor, because I know that you're a dude with your hand in a lot of different pots all at once, wearing a lot of different hats, and it sounds like you got some really interesting stuff coming up, and you're not totally sure about competition moving forward. But why don't you let listeners know all the various projects that you're involved with right now that hopefully we'll see in 2018, and how fans can reach out to you, whether that's for coaching or for anything else.
Yeah, well, you can always find me at troponinnutrition.com, and you can contact me as far as coaching, you know, through Facebook or Instagram or whatever. But Troponin Nutrition is where I do all my coaching through. You can also see me at MuscleMentor.net, and that's with Brad Hall. And that's a website which, you know, I feel like is a very good website. And I wish I had more time to push it, because we do a lot of really good things there. But it's a paid membership site. There's an anabolics course. But there's tons of free stuff also, and probably too much free stuff. This is something I always do, because I always end up, I'm not really a great businessman, as far as I'm good at doing lots of business, but not good about being stingy with making money, because my training logs are up there for free. Keith Fabry's training for the Junior Nationals, his training logs are up there for free. Dominic Trevlini and Dylan Severidis is going to put training logs up there. Got a couple other guys who are going to be putting training logs up there. These are all free, but there's an entire member section where we talk about, everything I wish I would have known coming up. And you can see what I'm doing currently with diet and supplements, what some clients of mine are doing with diet and supplements in the member section. And there's hours and hours and hours of video of up there in the member section also. That's MuscleMentor.net. And then I just started a project with Steve Kuklo. If you go to SteveKuklo.com, you can find an ebook, a masterclass ebook. It's a 100-page ebook that does, we discuss setting up a diet, setting up macronutrients, how to adjust things for off-season versus pre-contest. There's setting up training programs, how we approach training, how you approach nutrition around training. And then also something that I think other people don't have is approaching a lifestyle and how to actually create the lifestyle of whether or not you're a full-time, you're someone with a full-time job and a family, how to approach the lifestyle, but also how to approach the bodybuilding lifestyle as a financial venture rather than just a physical venture, and how to kind of take the, something I think we don't do good as bodybuilders is we have this ability to hyper-focus and be obsessed and devote all this self-driven energy towards, but we don't apply it to anywhere else in our life. You know, everyone loves Arnold Schwarzenegger and the fact that he took that same motivation from bodybuilding and applied it to everything else, right, and became as successful as he did. We all have that same self-motivation, but we don't do a good job in the community of fostering that idea of applying that. And we almost knock it down because as soon as a successful bodybuilder kind of leaves the sport to promote his business, we all knock him for not doing strictly bodybuilding anymore.
Right.
But we cover that in the ebook also. And there's diet plans there also on SteveKuklo.com. And also we're starting a Facebook group called The King's Club. That's a monthly fee Facebook group where you get, they'll be doing video conferencing with Steve and I. You can ask questions. We'll have, you know, like a forum there. And it's a pretty cool Facebook group. And that's it. So TroponinNutrition.com, MuscleMentor.net, and SteveKuklo.com.
Very cool. Any chance you're going to be at the Arnold in a couple weeks, Justin, or no?
Oh, I really want to. I have daddy-daughter dance that night.
Oh, so, baby. You know what? Do it while you can do it, because I just read a news story how about in New York they had to do away with the daddy-daughter dance
because it was
violating. What's that?
I just said what?
Yeah, and it was because it was violating the new laws when it comes to transgender, gender assignment, and it was unfair to call it a daddy-daughter. I'm not kidding. It's a news story. You can look it up.
Come on.
So, luckily,
your son, son cares that much, yeah, I can only imagine if I had a son, the last place he'd want to be is at the daddy-daughter dance. But don't drop the whole thing. I mean, my kids love it. You know, the girls, they're picking out their dresses right now. You know, it's all secretive. I'm not allowed to see it until that night. And we love that. That's a great night. You know, you take them out to dinner. You buy them flowers. They feel like, you know, they feel like a real important person for a while.
You know what it does, Justin? Because I did it with my ex. She had a daughter. Took her daughter. It teaches your little girl how they should expect to be treated.
Exactly, and that's something that's so missed. What, you know, they not just that they should be treated with respect, but it also teaches them the same thing of respecting the person they're with. And that's something that's why couples don't last anymore. Is that there's no one learns how to accept respect. Or, you know, and expect respect, but no one knows how to give respect either. And so there's no mutual respect between couples in a relationship. And I agree 100%. That's what that's really, as a father of a daughter, that's your number one purpose in life, is teaching them what a man should be for them, I guess.
Right.
And how they should be treated and how, I agree. I can't believe they're doing away with that.
Well, luckily, you know, insane modern millennial political correctness hasn't quite seeped fully into the Midwest all the way up to Michigan quite yet, but give it time. It'll be there in 2 to 5 years, you know.
Oh, yeah.
This is the way that it works. It works in from the coasts and good old liberal academia.
Yeah.
So, and then a specific email or Instagram for anyone that's looking for coaching, or just go through a website?
You go to the website. My Instagram is Troponin Nutrition. My Facebook is Justin Harris or Muscle Mentor. Go to the website and the contact us page. Troponin Nutrition is probably the easiest way.
Awesome. Justin, this has been a blast for me. I learned a lot, and I'm sure listeners did as well. I want to wish you the absolute best of luck in all of your future endeavors. I'll be following along, whether it's on the stage or not, because as a human being, you've always impressed the shit out of me for what it's worth, whether you're a pro bodybuilder or not.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, everybody, that was Justin Harris, and we want to thank you for listening to another episode of Beyond Driven Radio. We will be back with our next one as soon as I figure out what it's going to be. Other than that, peace out.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Beyond Driven Radio with David Johnston, and this week with Justin Harris. Later in the week, we'll have Justin Harris back again on Muscle Minds, featuring Dr. Scott Stevenson, myself, and we will be with Brad Hull, Justin's partner. Remember to subscribe to Stitcher or iTunes or your favorite podcast app, and follow us on social media. Thanks a lot, guys. We'll see you later in the week. Team Warrior Within, founded by David and Nikki Johnston. More than 14 years experience as full-time trainers and coaches. Through their online coaching service, they can help anybody who has a passion to make progress. From everyday people just looking to lose weight, build muscle, trim up, to contest prep for beginners, all the way to working with top-level IFBB pros. 100% month-to-month rates, no contracts. Check out the website, teamwarriorwithin.com, and visit Facebook, Team Warrior Within.
Hey guys, this is John Meadows.
And this is Scott Stevenson.
I invite everybody to come out to our seminar, Bodybuilding Fact and Fiction.
Thursday, March 1st at the Doubletree Suites in downtown Columbus. Just before the Arnold Classic festivities, come on in and meet John Meadows, IFBB Pro, the Mountain Dog himself, and Dr. Scott Stevenson. Stay all day from 9 a.m. to noon, then after lunch, 1 o'clock till 4. Starting out with an a.m. pancake breakfast, then all-day lectures. Q&A as time permits, plus best bar ever and pre-workout from Granite Supplement Speed Force to get you on your way to the gym. For more information, go to drscottstevenson.com. That's drscottstevenson.com. And hope to see you guys there.
Voices Radio Network.